With Good Friday coming up next Friday, I thought it may be an opportune time to consider the Passover. Now, that's not because I'm in bondage to the ecclesiastical calendar, but when a lot of people around the place are bothered about Easter eggs and Easter bunnies and all sorts of other extraneous issues, I thought it might be good for us to look at the Passover. That's where Easter came from. The Passover was one of the Jewish festivals, and it was governed by the phases of the moon. Easter grew out of the Passover, but that's why Easter shifts around from one year to the next. I'm going to read two passages. The first one in Matthew 26, and then we'll go back to the origins of the Passover in Exodus 12. Verse 17, Matthew 26. Now on the first day of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover?" He said, "Go into the city to such a one and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand, I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.'" The disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. We come in verse 20 to the evening. And it's the evening, and he sat at table with his 12 disciples. And as they were eating, he said, "Truly I say to you, one of you will betray me." And they were very sorrowful and began to say to him, one after another, "Is it I, Lord?" He answered, "He who has dipped his hand in the dish with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes, as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for him had he not been born." Judas, who betrayed him, said, "Well, is it I, Master?" He said, "You have said so." Now as they were eating, Jesus took bread, and blessed, and broke it, and gave to the disciples, and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink of it, all of you. For this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I shall not drink again of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom." And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Now back to Exodus chapter 12, the occasion when the people of Israel were about to leave Egypt. Pharaoh had been given enough warning, and now the judgment was to fall. The people of Israel are prepared to escape that judgment through the Passover. The first 13 verses we'll read. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, "This month shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you. Tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month they shall take every man a lamb according to their fathers' houses, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for a lamb, then a man and his neighbor next to his house shall take according to the number of persons. According to what each can eat, you shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male a year old. You shall take it from the sheep or from the goats. You shall keep it until the 14th day of the month, when the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill their lambs in the evening. And then they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and the lintel of the houses in which they eat them. They shall eat the flesh that night, roasted, and with unleavened bread and bitter herbs they shall eat it. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled with water, but roasted, its head with its legs and its inner parts. And you shall let none of it remain until the morning. Anything that remains until the morning you shall burn. In this manner you shall eat it, your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I will pass through the land of Egypt that night, and I will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and on all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. The blood shall be a sign for you upon the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague shall fall upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt." We won't read any further, but later on we read that in following generations, when their children asked them, "Why are you observing this Passover?" they were to explain to them that this was a remembrance or a memorial of their great escape from Egypt. So the Passover from the beginning was a memorial. In fact, it's in the very next verse there, verse 14, "This shall be for you a memorial day, and you shall keep it throughout your generations." Just a few details at the outset here. You notice that the month in which the Passover occurred was from that time forward to mark the first month of the year. And of course, it is called the Passover because the angel of the Lord passed over the houses where the sacrifice had been offered and the people had sprinkled the blood around the door. And the other point concerning the blood in verse 13, that the blood shall be a sign for you upon the houses. And when he saw the blood, the angel of the Lord passed over that house, did not execute judgment. The blood was a sign that an innocent substitute had borne the penalty in place of those within the house. The important issue was not simply that God liked red colouring around the door, nor was it that you could simply take a bit of blood from the animal and then let it run away and enjoy itself in the field if you sucked enough blood out of it with a little pipette or something and then you sort of splash it around the door. That was no good either. The animal was slain. That's the point. The animal was slain. And the blood was a sign, as it says here, the blood was a sign that the animal had been slain, that a life had been laid down in place of the one under judgment. And that significance of blood, of course, is developed at length in the sacrificial system. Let's now consider some of the regulations that related to this Passover. First of all, the animal was killed on the 14th day, late in the afternoon, getting towards evening, probably around about 3 or 4 o'clock, let us say, in the afternoon, on the 14th day of the month. The animal then provided the meat for a meal which was to be eaten that night. But that night, of course, was the 15th day of the month, because, as you know, the Israelites began their new day at sunset. Let us, for argument's sake, that the sun set at 6 o'clock. So the animal was killed at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then that night, in the evening, which was now the 15th day, they had the meal together. They ate the Passover. But the Passover meal was not a party. It was not a great celebration where people got dressed up in their finery and they went along and they ate into the small hours of the morning having a marvellous time together. It was a very serious business. There was no room for self-glory. They had to remember what it was all about. And there was no prettying up the whole thing either, no hundreds and thousands and little party hats and sparkling fizzy and things like that to make it all an exciting little party together. Not at all. It was a solemn occasion. No frills. I suppose that's the way to summarise it. No frills. They were to be dressed, ready for departure in the morning. It was to be eaten in haste. It says so here. You shall eat it in haste. And so it just didn't go on hours and hours and hours of wining and dining and things like that. They were to be dressed, ready to go. The animal was to be cooked very quickly. Barbecued, we'd say today. Roasted whole. No time for the niceties of slow cooking. Not to be boiled or anything like that, or baked in an oven, things that are going to take a long time. It was a fairly swift process, barbecued whole, cooked, roasted in the open. Also, we are told there that there was no yeast added to the bread, no leaven. Again, the haste, you see. We all know that it takes longer for the yeast to work through the bread and for it to rise if you bake it that way. But this was in haste, and so the bread was eaten unleavened. Another point that comes out of those verses we read is that there was no room in it for superstition. Human beings are very much inclined to superstition at times. For that reason, I believe, it doesn't say so here, but I believe that's the reason why it says that nothing shall be left over until the morning. If there is some left over, then you have to burn it. Because people are very much inclined to get lucky charms. And you could just imagine the people of Israel, and I can imagine people today would do the same thing. And lots of superstitions grow up among us. I've known some superstitions to develop in some of our churches. People wouldn't call them superstitions, but really that's what they are. There's a tendency in human nature towards superstition, and sometimes even in relation to the Lord's Supper, you find people develop some very odd taboos and practices. If a person had some left over, they might be inclined to keep it as a sort of lucky charm, and on the way to Egypt, they had a little bit of that bread poked in their pocket. Well, to make sure that nothing like that happened, they said, if anything of this lamb is left over, it's got to be burnt. God does not want his people hanging on to these little things as talisman or lucky charms. In conjunction with this feast of Passover, we have the feast of unleavened bread. And that lasted for 7 days. In fact, the two are put together very often as one festival. And you find it in the New Testament a number of times. It says, and when the feast of Passover and unleavened bread had come, the Passover started it off, and then for the next week went the feast of unleavened bread. The purpose of that was to remind them of the haste of their departure. So just as they left Egypt and then day after day were hot-footing it along the road, having no time to stop for the niceties of discourse and eating meals, but rather cooking their food in a hurry as they went, just as they did that when they left Egypt, so year by year in this festival, they were not only to remember the Passover, but also had a seven-day feast of unleavened bread to remind them likewise of their unceremonious escape from Egypt. I hope we can see the thrust of this. There's nothing they can skite about. I think that's the whole point of it. There's nothing you can skite about that you were very clever and that you achieved this by yourself. All is of God's grace, and they accepted God's grace by faith, and in faith they offered the sacrificial lamb. God saw the blood and he passed over them. I think we can see fairly obviously the picture there in relation to Christ's sacrifice for us, and the fact once again that there is nothing to skite about in our faith, in our salvation, as if we have achieved it, as if we have tizzied it up somehow and made it look attractive and made ourselves look attractive and appealed to God and impressed God. There's nothing. The whole thing is entirely of God's grace, and we are to remember that just as these people were to remember it. And so year by year they were reminded that their salvation was entirely the mercy of God acting on their behalf. Concerning this unleavened bread and the reason for it, we get a few verses here. In verse 15, for example, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, on the first day you shall put leaven out of your houses. Leaven, of course, had a tendency to spoil. In fact, that was part of the idea of it, to fermentation and the like. To ensure that there was no possibility of anything spoiling, they were to get rid of their leaven from their houses for the duration of this feast. If you come down to verse 33, again we have this reference to the people being in haste. The Egyptians were urgent with the people to send them out of the land in haste. The Egyptians said, "We're like dead men." The Egyptians were scared by this time. And so the people, that is the people of Israel, took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading bowls bound up in their mantles on their shoulders, which means that they cooked as they walked along the street. A similar thing is said across in verse 39. Verse 39, they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened. They had the dough, but there was no leaven in it, so it wasn't spoiling. And they had no ovens as they were walking along the road to bake bread in, and so they had to cook it in open pans, which they carried in baskets or something over their shoulders. They cooked these unleavened cakes which they had brought, or the dough they had brought from Egypt. It was unleavened because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not tarry. There it is again. They're in a hurry. Neither had they prepared for themselves any provisions. In fact, if you live in the East, you see this sort of thing quite common. In Thailand, we see hawkers going along the street and they've got a bamboo pole. At either end, they've got the basket. In one basket, they'll have a fire. It may be inside a half kerosene tin or something like that, or it might be a little clay stove. And so they walk around, they cook bananas or bits of meat or chicken or whatever they're cooking, so they can walk along and they can cook, and then they stop and sell it to passers-by and hawk it around the district like that. Cooking as you go along. That's what these people of Israel were doing as they fled from Egypt, cooking their food as they moved along, and for the next week there was much haste as they escaped from Egypt. So the whole thing is put together now in this feast of Passover and unleavened bread, as they remember their miraculous departure from the land of their bondage. Well, in due course they arrive in Canaan. It took them a long time to get there, as we well know. But when they got in Canaan, we are told there in the book of Deuteronomy that they were to observe this annual Passover and Feast of Unleavened Bread at the central place of worship, which of course originally was the tabernacle, and later on became the temple when it was built in Jerusalem. All males were to attend the Passover each year. Not only that, but in Exodus, a few chapters further on, we learn that even people who are not Israelites could participate in the Passover festival. They could partake of the food and enjoy all the benefits of that Passover meal, provided they had first of all become part of the covenant people. They became part of the covenant people, of course, by submitting to the initiation rite of circumcision, and so in effect becoming part of Israel. Even though they were not by blood Israelites, they became part of Israel as they went through the covenant initiation ceremonies and entered into the covenant. There's another issue that arises in Numbers and is referred to again in Deuteronomy. I'm not going to turn to all these verses, but it's there that says also there was a provision for those who, for some legitimate reason, were not able to be at the official Passover. Now a person may have been away in country on business, And a long way away, he could have been detained by some accident or floods or some legitimate excuse, and he could not get to the central place of worship for the Passover. If that was the case, provision was made to have the Passover at a similar time the following month for those people. Everybody else had to go through it at the ordinary time, but there were these provisions for exceptional cases. And so you see how God is providing for his people and for those who originally were not his people but have now become his people through entering the covenant, and so it goes on. And when we come to the time of Jesus, we find also that Jesus and his family went along to the Passover in Jerusalem. If you read through the Old Testament, you get some very revealing matters concerning the Passover. I'm not going to go into all of them, but it does seem that very often the whole thing fell into disuse. They got lazy, like the rest of us, I guess. They become slack, and sometimes they forget, and so they drift away into bad habits. And in times of spiritual depression, they had stopped observing the Passover. And then would come along an enthusiastic king like Josiah or Hezekiah or someone like this, and these kings reactivated things and they observed the Passover, and there was great rejoicing. And then of course they go away into captivity and it falls into disuse again, but then they come back into their land after the captivity and marvellous rejoicing again as they reinstitute the Passover. And so Israel had a very checkered history, as this Passover was sometimes neglected and sometimes observed. By the time you get to the New Testament, the Passover has gone through quite a few changes. From here on in, now we're going to be in the New Testament. You find, for example, in Luke, we won't turn to all of these, I'll pick out one or two maybe that we can look at. In Luke chapter 2, you have the well-known story of Jesus as a boy of 12 years of age going with his parents to Jerusalem for the Passover. It indicates again that he came from a godly family who were keen to observe the requirements under the covenant. And in John's Gospel, we get a number of references to the Passover. In fact, if you only read, let us say, Matthew, Mark and Luke, you may get the impression that the whole of Jesus' ministry, his public ministry, was discharged inside 1 year, and almost all in Galilee, because there is very little in the way of references to time that would cause us to think otherwise. But when you come to John, you learn there that some portion of Jesus' ministry was spent in Jerusalem, and his ministry extended over 3.5 years. This is because there are a number of Passovers mentioned in John's Gospel. Three are mentioned specifically as Passovers, and since the Passover occurred only once a year, you can very easily add up the number of years. There's one other festival that's not named that almost certainly is a Passover. So if there were the four Passovers, well, that is why you can then work out the 3.5 years of Jesus' public ministry. Well, the first of those Passovers was, of course, the one where he went to Jerusalem and cleansed the temple, referred to in John chapter 2. But the most significant, and the one I want to concentrate on now, is the final Passover, when Jesus went to Jerusalem and offered himself as a sacrifice, the time of his crucifixion, in other words. John refers to this in some length. We might just look at chapter 12. The opening verse tells us that 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, and there we have the story of how Mary anointed his feet with the ointment. Later on in verse 20, we are introduced to a number of Greeks who went up to worship at this Passover festival. This harks back to what we are looking at in the Old Testament, where we see that there were non-Jewish people who came and joined in the Passover. Now, whether these people specifically joined in all the details, we are not told, because there were two types of Gentiles, two types of Greeks, let us say, non-Jewish people. There were those who had formally joined the Jewish religion, had undergone the rite of circumcision, and had taken the covenant requirements upon themselves, and so were full-blown Jews, so to speak, even though not born Jews. They were called proselytes, or converts to Judaism. But then there were a lot of others who are commonly referred to as God-fearers. They feared God. They were attached to the Jewish temple, but they were not really part of the Jewish system. A little bit like people who will go along to churches today. They're not really part of the church. They're not part of the fellowship. They may not partake of communion and things of that nature, but they may be interested enough to wander along to church occasionally on special occasions. They tend to fear God, but they're not really Christians because they're not committed to Jesus Christ as Saviour. Now, there are a lot of people among the Jews who are comparable with that. They sort of went along to the temple and to the synagogue. They were not full-blown Jews, but they liked to listen to the sermons. Perhaps the Greeks were among those. You You meet a lot of these in the book of Acts, incidentally. You know Cornelius, the Roman soldier? It says he feared God. Now, he was an Italian, but he feared God. And later on he became a Christian. And then there's Lydia. She feared God. She was another one. Not a Jew at all. And then you have an Ethiopian, a man from Africa. He had been to Jerusalem to worship. He was a worshipper of God. He feared God. One of these people loosely attached to the Jewish temple. Here we find these Greeks, and they have come up at this Passover time. Great crowds of people came to Jerusalem at Passover time. We are told in Matthew 26, at the beginning of the chapter we read earlier, that one of the reasons that the Jewish leaders hesitated to arrest Jesus openly in Jerusalem was because of the crowds that were there. They were frightened that the crowds might create a disturbance if Jesus was arrested publicly, and it says so. They feared to arrest him because of the crowds of people there for the festival, and emotions were running high. But their problem was solved when Judas volunteered to betray Jesus privately. And so it was now an inside job, so to speak. One of Jesus' own group betrayed him, and this way they worked their little bit of skullduggery privately without having to go through the hassle of some sort of public riot through arresting him, through manhandling him in public. But all of these things I'm just mentioning to show how people flocked to Jerusalem for this Passover feast. Now, over the centuries, a number of changes had come into the way they observed the Passover feast. Traditions develop, little practices get tacked on, and of course we are now well over 1,000 years since Moses first instituted the Passover back in the days of Egypt. Well, among the changes and additions that had come in, you find now that the meal was no longer eaten at the temple, but was eaten at home. They still killed the animals at the temple. They killed the animals in the afternoon, and then they ate the meal at night, just as you have in the Law of Moses. In the afternoon of the 14th, around about 3 or 4 o'clock, they killed the animals, but then they took the animal home, and the meal was held that night in their own homes. That was, of course, the 15th. The day on which they killed the animals was called the Day of Preparation. It was the day when they prepared the animals, killed them, and then prepared them for the meal that night. Well, when they had the meal that night, they again had the unleavened bread, and they had bitter herbs and various drinks that were passed around. In fact, a number of cups were passed around at various stages through the meal. One of these cups was called the Cup of Blessing, and it's referred to in the New Testament. This cup of blessing which we bless, says Paul. The cup of blessing for which we give thanks to God is referred to the cup of wine that was passed around at the Christian communion. The very first Lord's Supper grew out of the last of the Passovers that Jesus had with his disciples. And that's the reference then to the food that was there, the unleavened bread that was on the table and the wine as it was passed around. And as I say, this cup was passed around a number of times during the meal. And that accounts for the variations we get in the Gospels. You've no doubt wondered at times why it is that in Luke the cup is mentioned first and the bread mentioned second, whereas in Matthew and Mark the bread is mentioned first and the cup is mentioned second. Well, this is because the cup went round several times during the meal, before and after, and then they took bread and they partook of the Passover lamb and so on. That was the general procedure that applied as people normally observed the Passover. They also sang some songs. The songs came from the book of Psalms, and together is known as the Hallel, H-A-L-L-E-L, Psalms 113 to 118, and these were spaced out at different times during that Passover meal. We have, again, a reference in what we read before, that when they had finished the Lord's Supper, the bread and the wine, and then at the end it says they sang a hymn and they went out, a reference to those songs that were sung. Well, let's now specifically think of Jesus' last Passover. It appears to me that Jesus actually had the Passover meal a day earlier than usual. Jesus was crucified on the Friday, but it seems that he had a special Passover meal with his disciples on the Thursday. Of course, he was not going to be around on the Friday. Special circumstances. And we saw from Numbers and Deuteronomy that provision was given there, in special circumstances, that the Passover could be held at a time other than that which was originally laid down. In Luke 22, where we get some of the details, in verse 15, please yourself if you turn to all of these, because I think you know the stories well enough. In Luke 22:15, Jesus said to them, "I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." And the emphasis seems to me to be there. Now, normally I might be eating this tomorrow when everybody else is going to have the Passover supper, but I want to eat this with you now before I suffer, because tomorrow I am going to be crucified. Now, he doesn't say that, and the disciples aren't entirely awake to what's happening, but Jesus wants to have that meal with them. He sends out his disciples, Peter and John, to look out the place to prepare for that supper. Luke 22, verse 8. Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, "Go and prepare the Passover for us, that we may eat it." Now, they didn't quite know where to go, but Jesus had arranged with another person where it was going to be held. You know, the man who carried the water jar. There was only two people knew where the Passover was going to be held. The two people were Jesus and the man carrying the water jar. Jesus had worked that out earlier because Jesus knew that Judas was up to skullduggery, and he knew that Judas wanted to betray him. But Jesus had a lot to get through yet. He wanted to have that Last Supper with his disciples. He wanted to give them a lot of teaching in that upper room, and it wasn't yet his time to be betrayed. He didn't yet want to hand himself over. And to make sure that Judas didn't get in first, Jesus kept it silent. So Judas had no way of going to the priests to tell them where they could arrest him, because Judas didn't know. Nobody knew except Jesus and that man who carried the water jar. And that's why Jesus set this little sign, and he said to these other two disciples, Peter and John, "Now you go down, and when you walk around the corner, you'll find a fellow walking up and down the street carrying a water jar. Just follow him. He'll take you to an upper room. Then you can prepare it and get ready for the supper." And in this way, of course, they prepared the supper, and they all went along, and nobody knew where they were going until they actually got there. And that pulled the rug from under Judas. It stopped him doing his horrible deed. And it was only then, after Jesus had got together with his disciples, and then we know later on Judas went out, and then he betrayed. And by the time I've caught Jesus, he was in the Garden of Gethsemane. So they're preparing this meal. But where is the lamb? Well, I gather that there was no lamb there. But Jesus was having this meal with his disciples before he suffered, and the next day Jesus himself, as we know, would be crucified. So it was the Last Supper, and I don't believe there was a lamb there at all. The other was there, the unleavened bread, the wine, the singing of the songs, and all the other things, but no lamb. As if one might say, "Where is the lamb?" And as if he might say, "God will provide himself a lamb." And the next day, of course, Jesus Christ himself died. And he indeed was the Passover lamb, as we well know. When we look at what happened then the next day, after that Last Supper, Jesus had that Last Supper, we've read about it in Matthew chapter 26, and then there was the Garden of Gethsemane, and then he was arrested in the middle of the night. He was dragged before the Jewish authorities and went through that horrible trial, 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, the cock crows, daylight is breaking. And then they decide they'll march him round to Pilate, because Pilate is the Roman governor. He has come to Jerusalem. He normally lives at Caesarea down on the coast, but because there's great crowds in Jerusalem for the Passover, he comes every year to keep these highly strung people under control during the festival. In chapter 18 of John, verse 28, it says, "They led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the Praetorium," that's where Pilate was residing. "They led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas, the priest, round to Pilate, the governor, and it was early." The very previous verse that says the cock has just crowed. So I should imagine it's very, very early indeed. The cock has just crowed, the first crack of dawn, and if you think that's rather early in the morning to go worrying the Roman governor, let me assure you that in places, in societies where there's no electricity, everybody gets up very, very early, and they go to bed quite early. We've become so used to electricity that it's changed our way of life enormously from what it was then. People went to bed not all that long after dark, and they were up at what we would consider to be a pretty unearthly hour of the morning. Nothing at all unusual to go around to see the Roman governor at the crack of dawn sometime. And in fact, in the next chapter, chapter 19, when they were before Pilate, in verse 14, it says it was the day of preparation of Passover. This is the Friday now, it's the day of preparation of Passover. This was the day on which they normally killed their lambs. It was about the sixth hour, 6 o'clock in the morning, I take that to mean. And that is when Pilate has his action there with Jesus, and of course condemns him to death. We know then that Jesus was led out to be crucified, and we are told in Mark that it was about 9 o'clock in the morning that he was actually put on the cross. He hung on the cross from 9 o'clock in the morning till about midday, and then at midday there was this great darkness came over all the land. There was darkness over all the land from midday till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It is here somewhere. Anyway, you know the reference well enough yourself, don't you? And then at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Jesus yielded up his spirit. So, he's on the cross from 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock, 6 hours, The last 3 hours of that is this weird darkness. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he says it is finished. His dead body remains on the cross approximately another 3 hours until 6 o'clock in the evening, and then loving hands take him down and give him an honourable burial. And here in John we are told once again in verse 31, where people said, since it is the day of preparation, in order to prevent the bodies from remaining on the cross on the Sabbath, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken. But we know that didn't happen. Another one of those little spin-offs here, no bone of him was broken, which of course was one of the requirements for the Paschal lamb, the Passover lamb. And then the very final verse, because of the Jewish day of preparation, as the tomb was close at hand, they laid Jesus there. Again, the day of preparation. Now the animals were killed on that day of preparation, round about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So it seems that at the very time that the Jews were there killing their animals in the temple courtyard was the very time that Jesus himself was yielding up his spirit on the cross, round about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He was the Passover lamb. It was this very same Jesus who had instituted the Lord's Supper for his people, that they might remember him, just you might say as these Israelites were remembering their great deliverance. But now Christ himself becomes the Passover lamb. And we're told in Peter that we are not redeemed with corruptible things like silver and gold, but with the precious blood of Christ as of a lamb without blemish and without spot. Now that was another requirement. The lamb had to be without blemish and without spot. No bone of it was to be broken, and that again is referred to in John chapter 19, verse 36. And when we come to Corinthians, Paul there tells us that Christ is our Passover. Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed for us. Jesus, when he was instituting that feast, said, "Remember me." And so the memorial element is there also. Just as the Passover was a remembrance of that great deliverance, so it is with the Lord's Supper. But when they remembered the Passover, when they had the Passover, it was not a case of them remembering the sufferings of the lamb and things like that. It was a case of remembering all that God had done for them through that Passover deliverance. And so when we remember Jesus Christ, it is not simply a remembrance of his suffering, that's part of it, but we remember him. We remember all that God has done for us, all that Christ is, all that he's done for us through his sacrificial death. It is not simply a reminder of the fact that he suffered. It is a remembrance of him, his total person, and all that he has done. Now if all we were going to do or simply remember him and his sufferings, one could think of some objects that might arouse our imagination more than a loaf of bread and a cup of wine on a table. When you look at a loaf of bread and a cup of wine on a table, it doesn't exactly remind you on the surface of someone suffering some horrific death. Last week I visited that church out there at Richmond. Saw some of the old buildings around Richmond. We wandered into one of the churches there, with all these paintings and statues and crucifixes and things around them. Statue of the Christ on the cross, and then a lot of paintings of Christ carrying his cross and going out to his place of crucifixion. Some of them were quite moving. Now, in many ways, that sort of thing arouses our imagination and does something to us, which perhaps bread and wine may not do, as you just look at it there sitting on the table. But you see, Jesus was not saying, imagine how I suffered. That wasn't what he was saying. He wasn't saying, picture in yourself what I've done. He was saying, do this in remembrance of me. Do you get it? Do this. Not something you just think about, it's something you do. And that's the point of the Lord's Supper, that we actually do something. The bread which we break, is it not a participation in the body of Christ? The wine which we drink, is it not a participation in the blood of Christ? And so we partake of the bread and the wine as we jointly have communion, interaction, participation with one another and with the risen Christ. It's something we do. We take bread, we take wine, you do this, so that we're all involved in it, as all of those who have been redeemed, entering afresh into all that the living Christ means to us, and actually physically doing something as we participate in the Lord's Supper. And so we take those elements of bread and wine together, remembering who Christ is, what he's done, and having fellowship with him and with each other. That's one of the applications that you find developed in the New Testament. You read about it in Matthew 26, and you find it developed further in 1 Corinthians 10, as Paul speaks about what the communion, the Lord's Supper, really means in terms of our participation together in a living act of worship. But there's another application Paul makes of it in 1 Corinthians 5, 7 and 8, and we might just look at that in conclusion. The church in Corinth had a few problems. People had been misbehaving, and among their misbehavior was some rather aberrant sexual behavior. People were rather disgracing themselves in the church, and the church took a fairly lax attitude to this. So Paul says to them in verse 6 that they ought not to be so slack, and in verse 7 he says, cleanse out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you really are unleavened. For Christ, our Paschal Lamb, has been sacrificed. Let us therefore celebrate the festival not with the old leaven, the leaven of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Here Paul is drawing out the practical implications for us. And what are the practical implications? Well, the practical implications are that leaven is significant of evil. Now, it may not always be significant of evil in the Bible. We find that sometimes things are referred to, sometimes they're good and sometimes they're bad. The picture of seed, sometimes seed can be seed which is evil and brings forth evil fruit. Sometimes seed can be good, which brings forth good fruit. Sometimes leaven may refer to something which is good and has a good influence, but in the majority of cases it refers to something evil which permeates, which spreads through and affects everything that it touches. That's the way Paul is referring to it here. That's the way Jesus referred to it on some occasions when he spoke of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of the Sadducees and the leaven of the Herodians, the hypocrisy and the false teaching and the compromise and things like that. Well, here again we find the leaven being referred to. And what Paul is saying is this: look, if we are Christians and we have partaken the benefits of Christ's sacrifice, we have had communion with him, interacting with him with each other, remembering him and all he's done for us, and partaking together of bread and wine, actually doing this in remembrance of him, living as Christians who partake of the benefits of Christ's sacrifice, then he says the time has surely arrived when we must do something about getting rid of the leaven, just as the Jews got rid of the leaven. But in your case, he says, the leaven is the leaven of malice and evil. And notice that even though he's speaking in the context of a deep moral problem in the church, when he applies the teaching, it comes down to something that is far more widespread. Some of us might stand up and with holy righteousness shake the finger at some of the immoral behavior around the place. But Paul drives it home in such a way that we can't congratulate ourselves in any sort of self-righteous attitude. He says, the leaven of malice and evil. And I'm afraid that that sort of leaven is what corrupts God's people far more. We're all prone to it. It can affect us all. And yet sometimes we can congratulate ourselves because we think that we're holy, we think that we're pious, we think that we don't engage in some of the misbehavior that other people might engage in. And yet we can be thoroughly wrong in God's sight. We can be affected by this leaven of malice and evil which eats away at the soul, which expresses itself through jealousy and hate and hypocrisy, an unforgiving spirit, and all sorts of other malicious and evil attitudes within. And those are the things, says Jesus, which really corrupt a person. If we have known Christ as our Paschal Lamb, and we've been forgiven and we've been saved like those people were because of the sacrifice that has delivered us from judgment, surely, says Paul, the time has passed when we ought to be slack about evil. Surely it's up to us to realize that we have to purge out that leaven so that we may be unleavened bread, producing fruits of sincerity and truth. Some of the things I think we ought to remind ourselves of as we think afresh of that first Passover and then the last Passover, which became the first of the Lord's Suppers, and as week by week we worship our Lord in the Lord's Supper, let us take to heart these practical implications for us. Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed for us. Let us, therefore, celebrate the festival, the Christian life, live the Christian life, not with the old leaven of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth.